The Conference Committee on Senate File 166 will come to order. I don't even know what day it is today. It must be the 29th of April, 2009. And this is our first Conference Committee meeting. Was talking earlier about, earlier before the meeting, about an opportunity perhaps to meet after session. I don't know what people's schedule is. We don't have to answer that question now, but maybe we will be able to finish this today. I'm trying to think about what's the best opportunity for people to, for any kind of testimony. And I know it would be very limited, but at least give interested parties an opportunity to say, you know, give their opinion to us. Both houses passed relatively strong anti-STOLI or stranger originated life insurance policy provisions, and there are some differences, two different approaches, and we're going to have staff go through that. I'd like to have us introduce ourselves. I see somebody I haven't met yet at the table, so why don't we do that? And I will introduce myself. I'm Linda Scheid. I'm a state senator from Brooklyn Park and also represent Brooklyn Center. And I chair the Senate Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. And do you want to?
Kate Knuth, state representative from New Brighton, and have been carrying the STOLI bill in the House.
It seems like a long time, right?
And I'm Tom Pender from the House Research Department.
I'm Representative Deborah Hillstrom. I represent all of the city of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park, and Linda Scheid is my state senator.
You lucky person. We're both lucky.
Although I am not your state rep.
No, you're not. My bad luck, but don't tell Representative Nelson I said that. Yeah. No.
I will.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Loon. I'm the new state rep for Eden Prairie, District 42B. It's the old Eric Paulson
okay.
seat. It's how most people recognize it. And I'm just really honored to be part of this conference committee.
Good morning. Joe Atkins in Burgrove, chair of the House Commerce Committee.
Ann Russ from New York, chair of the state and local government.
Me Moore, I represent the east side of St. Paul, and I chair the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Chris Dang, Senate Counsel.
And do staff people want to say who they are so that...
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm Jamie Olson. I'm Senator Scheid's legislative assistant.
I'm Tanji Harrison. I'm Senator Scheid's committee administrator.
I'm Lynn Michelson, Senate Republican Research.
Sandra Boone, Senate Majority Research.
John Wright, committee administrator with the House Counsel Committee.
Kate Leaf, DFL Caucus Research with the House.
Chris Kwapik, legislative assistant.
Thank you. So we're going to have Mr. Pender and Mr. Stang go through the bill with us. And Darlene Sliwa is here. She is Senate staff as well. So did they adjourn the other meeting? Oh no. Okay. So we both left a meeting to be here. So whichever you gentleman wants to go first.
I'll start, Madam Chair. Members, I think mostly we'll be working off this bill comparison summary that Tom Pender and I put together, which highlights the differences in the two bills. I think you also have the reviser side by side with the actual bill language in your packets as well. Section one of the bill is the same in the House and Senate, just cites a bill as the Insurable Interest Act. Section two of the bill is the definition sections and defines terms used in the bill. That is the same in both the House and Senate, except that the House does not define the terms chronically ill or terminally ill. The Senate had a floor amendment which took out the substantive provision which used those terms, so those terms are really no longer needed in the Senate file either. Other differences in the definition section are the House has the phrase prohibited by Section 60A.085 or otherwise in the definition of legitimate settlement contracts.
On line 17, right?
Line 17, line 1.117 on the reviser side by side, if you want to look at that. And also, the House uses the term spoken rather than verbal in the definition of stranger-originated life insurance practices, and that's on line 3.25 of the House side. the Senate language is 3.32 on the Senate side, if you want to look at that. Section 3 is the section which requires that there be an insurable interest in a person before you are allowed to take out a life insurance policy on them. It also specifies what constitutes an insurable interest. I gather the provision there that which is generated the most controversy is the general principle on the bottom of page R3. The paragraph A there on both sides, that an individual has an insurable interest in the life of another person to whom the individual is closely related by blood or by law, or in whom the individual has a substantial interest engendered by love and affection. I think that might have received some attention, especially in the House, but both bodies are the same on that now. And the same in the rest of that section. Section 4, both bills deal with prohibited practices. In general terms, this is the section that prohibits the use of STOLI, stranger-originated life insurance practices, and other defined practices in connection with the procurement of life insurance, and the House and Senate are identical on that. Section 5 of the bill, each bill, this is really where the significant or the most significant differences in the two bills are. The Senate, Subdivision 1, presumption of STOLI practices, the Senate provides that a settlement contract entered into within 5 years of issuance creates a rebuttable presumption of STOLI practices if the insured underwent a life expectancy evaluation within 18 months before issuance, and there was an agreement before issuance to sell the policy, or the premiums for the policy were funded by other than personal assets or full recourse financing. The House language, and if you want to look at the actual language, it's on the bottom of page R6. Moving on to the top of page R7, the House language prohibits a settlement contract entered into prior to or within 4 years of the issuance of a policy unless the prospective purchaser determines there was no agreement before issuance to sell the policy, or both the following are present. One, all or a portion of premiums were funded by means other than the insured's personal assets or provided by closely related persons. And two, the insured underwent a life expectancy evaluation within 18 months before issuance, and the results were used by others to determine the value of the policy in the secondary market. So as I said, that section, actually subdivision one of that section, are really where the main or most significant differences in these two bills are. Subdivision 2 of Section 5, legitimate insurance transactions, just provides that nothing in this act prevents specified legitimate insurance transactions. The House language is the same, except they also include a phrase connected to a legitimate settlement contract on line 7.35 on the House side of the bill. Moving on to Section 6, processing change of ownership or beneficiary requests. This language requires an insurer to respond within 30 calendar days with written acknowledgement, confirming that a requested change of ownership or beneficiary of a policy has been effected, or specifying why the change can't be processed. It also specifies the form and contents of a questionnaire an insurer may requires a condition of effecting the change. The House language in Section 6 is very similar. It's mostly carries through conforming changes that reflects the differences they had in Section 5, Subdivision 1. Those include using the term 4-year period instead of 5 on line 8.12, of the House side. They use the term circumstances described in section 60A.0785 are present instead of presumption under section 60A.0785 applies on line 8.16. Use the term, again, circumstances described in section 60A.0785 are present instead of conditions listed in that section have been met on line 8.1, line 8.23, and use the term policy owner instead of there on line 8.29, but otherwise the section is the same. I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Pender to finish it out.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to Section 7, Fraudulent Acts. This section defines or specifies certain acts related to STOLE-type transactions as being fraudulent, and generally they involve misrepresentations at the time of taking out the policy that involve a person getting a policy that would be a STOLE-type policy by committing fraudulent acts, misrepresenting facts, and so on. And it specifies then that those fraudulent acts constitute insurance fraud under another existing statute that deals with insurance fraud. And generally, that statute generally treats insurance fraud as theft and makes the consequences the same as the consequences under the Criminal Fraud Act in terms of, depending on how much money is involved, it could be a misdemeanor, a gross misdemeanor, or a felony based on how much money someone was defrauded out of. So that's Section 7 basically is a criminal penalty provision. Then Section 8 deals with, I didn't say that. The House and Senate versions are identical in Section 7. Section 8, Subdivision 1, deals with civil remedies when a policy is initiated by STOLE practices or otherwise violating one of the earlier sections of this bill. And the House bill is identical, except the House bill adds a cross-reference to Section 5 of the bill at lines 9.23 and 9.24. They're referring to Section 5 of the bill that defines what a STOLE practice is. So it's basically just a cross-reference. Then Subdivision 2 of Section 8 deals with enforceability of contracts and provides that contracts that are prohibited under this act are voidable, meaning that a party to that contract would have the legal right to have the contract declared void. And the House provision on that is identical. Then Subdivision 3 of the section of the Senate version provides the ability to get a declaratory judgment, to go to court and get a court judgment that the policy was initiated by STOLE practices and get a court order then declaring the policy void, which would be the right of the person seeking that under Subdivision 2 that says that a STOLE-type transaction is voidable. And the House has no comparable provision on that. Section 4, Subdivision 4 of the Senate bill provides a statute of limitations saying that a legal action brought under this act to enforce rights under this act must be brought within 3 years after the death of the insured. And the House has no comparable provision on that. And I think the result of that would be that under the House version, the normal statute of limitations would apply, which would be 6 years. Then subdivision 5, effect on other laws, and this basically says that this act doesn't preempt other civil remedies or authority of law enforcement or limit power granted to the Commissioner of Commerce or to the Attorney General to investigate possible violations of laws. In other words, this bill doesn't affect any other remedies that are out there that could be used for these same kinds of circumstances. And the House version on that is identical. Section 9 is a repealer, and it repeals two existing laws in the chapter of laws dealing with life insurance that deal with insurable interest. And I think that's on the theory that this is replacing those provisions that were enacted, I think, during the earlier mid-90s. And the House is the same on those repealers. And then Section 10 is the effective date, and it makes the act effective for policies issued on or after August 1st of this year, and the House version is identical on that.
And that's it. And it's so nice because the format of the bills are still the same. So I've been in so many conference committees where you're bouncing around from section to section. At least the sections deal with the same subject matter. So are there any questions by anybody? Senator Rest. I don't really remember why. I've been asking myself, Senator Rest, that question. I personally think that if we went with what the House take on it, which means, you know, which would be not having it in there, that would probably be fine.
Well, I think I like the House position better on this particular area. It got taken out in a committee along the way.
The 3-year?
Uh-huh.
That was in the original bill, Madam Chair?
It was in the original bill, yeah. Yeah.
And the argument for doing that, taking it out, was what?
Frankly, it was an amendment. I didn't, if I remember right, this was in the Civil Justice Committee, and it was amendment. I didn't want to go on my bill, but I like this particular provision of it once it went on. So I didn't argue for it in the committee because there was some other major problems with the amendment that it was included in. And I think it kind of went on, and we figured out after that this is something that I have no problem with.
No, that's fine.
What could have been an argument for having a 3-year statute of limitations that let anyone to
right, and I don't recall. I don't know if that's in the NAIC or NCLIL models at all. Just maybe Ms. Rowan would.
Do you want to go there?
Why don't you, please? Yeah.
Three years is definitely insured, though. It could be longer than 6 years. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
This is true. It has to do with the death of the insured. So
the contract could have been done years before.
So,
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
Rowan.
Members of the committee, Robin Rowan, I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And to the point of the statute of limitations, it has to do with the right of the estate to recover the death benefit from the investors if a STOLI transaction was involved. Mm-hmm. And there was no science to the 3 years. It seemed a reasonable time for them to figure out if that was, in fact, the case. We're fine with what I think would be 6 now that it's been taken out. But that was the original intent.
So no
arrest. I don't think there's, you know, and I have a question perhaps for Mr. Stanger, Mr. Pender, or both, and that has to do with the declaratory judgment action. And I know, Ms. Rowan, you may want to stay there but down in subdivision 5, it says this act shall not preempt things that include declaratory judgments, but do you think we need the declaratory judgment language? I know the House doesn't have that in it as well.
Madam
Chair, members of the committee, we actually think the declaratory judgment language is very important and prefer the Senate position on that particular point for two reasons. One is that the declaratory judgment language in the Senate bill orders the causes of action. An insurance company has the ability now at any time to bring a cause of action to rescind a policy if there's a lack of insurable interest, because the Supreme Court has considered that void, that policy void from inception. But what this bill does is then transfer that that right to the estate. So what the declaratory judgment language does is order the claims, if you will. So the insurance company has the ability to bring that action until they pay the death benefit. Normally, they could still bring it afterwards. But what this bill does is says the insurance company can bring it until they pay the death benefit. Once the death benefit is paid, that right belongs to the estate only. Without that language in there, the insurer and the estate could have a competing action after the death benefit is paid, and we didn't think that made a lot of sense.
So you like the Senate language in there, and I get it.
Correct.
Ms. Rowan, thank you. Mr. Pender?
I wanted to correct something I said earlier.
Okay.
it's
about time, Mr. Pender. No, I don't know.
It involves the statute of limitations. I said that without this provision saying it's 3 years after the death of the insured, that it would have the normal 6-year statute of limitations. But actually, I think under normal situations, the statute of limitations would be 6 years from whenever the fraudulent act or whenever it was committed,
right,
which could be
right
when the insurance policy was issued. And that period could conceivably expire before the death of the person. So I'm going to retract what I said.
Okay, that's more clear. Ms. Rowan?
Then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, then I think we do need that language in there.
Senator Restrepo,
and Senator Gerlach has arrived. And what area do you represent, Senator Gerlach? You live in Apple Valley.
Introductions.
Yes, we did.
I'm from Apple Valley. I live in Rosemount, Virginia. Okay. I just thought Senator Rush should just hear that explanation.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I corrected something I said earlier about the statute of limitations. I said that in the absence of this provision saying it's 3 years after the death of the insured, that it would be the normal 6 years. And that's true, it would be the normal 6 years, but it wouldn't be the 6 years after the death of the insured. It would be 6 years after the fraudulent act was committed, which would usually be when a policy was issued, or shortly before that. And so therefore, that 6 year period could expire before the death of the person.
Right.
So
it has to be.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
With that different explanation, I think there is that's something we'll need. Seems like having a statute of limitations before the death benefit is paid out.
Representative Atkins.
Whatever you want to call me. The point of these STOLI policies, right, is that the insured person dies soon.
Everything goes according to plan. So my
question is whether or not the 6 years might actually be longer if, in fact, the person dies within the likely period of time, which I've been told is pretty quick, within a year or two or whatever. If we've got fraudulent act took place today, whatever the date is, I don't know what the date is either. But
I guess it's the
29th of April 2009. With 6 years, you'd have till 2015 to present your claim. With 3 years from the date of death, if the date of death is a year from now, then you'd only have 2011. So if the goal is to, maximize the opportunity to present the claim, I think we need to think it through. The other, the concern I have is if the person doesn't die till 2027, You're putting out a statute of limitation. The triggering mechanism is kind of unique here, where you'd have a statute of limitations that goes out till 2030. And I know at least on the House floor, we've had some really long debates about, it actually is in the context of priest abuse and what was the discovery of the event and so forth. It gets really muddy if you don't put some certainty with respect to it. And I'm just saying that whatever, we got to be careful at how we trigger this.
Right, and coupling that with what Ms. Rowland said is the intention here is to give the insurer, the insurance company, just a limited amount of time, so that has to do with when the benefits are paid. So, like,
then, if I may,
yes,
Madam Chair, what we may want to do, if that's the goal, is to set out a very limited window, whatever that, you know, from the date of death. 3 years is normally from the date of the act. Whatever, you know, I was just checking the statute of limitations. It's usually from the date of the fraud, the date of the accident, the whatever, as opposed to some put off point. But then you could arguably, you could put in a statute of repose that says no longer than X from the date of the act.
Or,
you know, we have similar kinds of things in construction warranty type cases and that sort of, so that we don't get into 2030 being our statute of limitations date.
And Chair, couldn't you have one or the other, whichever is less? Either 6 years from the date of the act or 3 years after the date of death, whichever is shorter or longer, however you want.
Yeah, however you want.
You know, whichever
that.
Way.
Yeah,
you want
I
to
don't
go.
Know if Mr. Stang or Mr. Pender have some ideas on that. I think there's some interest in fixing this,
yeah.
Having some language and but fixing it, perhaps, so it doesn't take carry on until 2030.
Madam Chair, I guess I would be concerned about whether going back to the priest thing again, but whether the action truly isn't known about until after 6 years and the person dies, and then all of a sudden, there it is. I mean, how would they know until the person died that they had been, I mean, sometimes people do things and you don't know about them until after they die, and that might be, you know, 6 years and one day, and then you'd be out of luck.
Well, and I think the...
I mean, to prosecute the fraud.
The burden is on the insurer to figure out whether or not there were stolen practices, I think. I mean, that's what at least this says. If the insurer believes the policy was initiated by stolen practices, I mean, that's what this statute, maybe Ms. Rowan, come back up again.
You may just want to stay
up. And in the meantime, I want to announce that Brooklyn Park is very well represented in this case. Because Representative Portman has joined
be
us.
A particular
we introduced ourselves.
Of Brooklyn Park.
There are three of us representing it. It's doing well today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the statute of limitations language is really intended to apply to the estate's cause of action, not the insurance companies. If you have the statute of limitations language in there and the declaratory judgment language in there, the insurance company's right to rescind the policy expires when they pay the death benefit, maybe a bad choice of word. But the statute of limitations was then intended to apply to this estate's cause of action. So they very well may not, to Senator Rest's point, know about it until they discover that there was a life insurance policy, but they're not getting the proceeds.
I think that's an important issue.
Yes.
Whichever way you decide.
Thank you.
Sure.
Madam Chair, I just looked. A lot of the remedies here in subdivisions one, for example, speak to actions to recover benefits from people they were paid to. Those benefits would only be paid after death. So I don't think it makes sense to have a statute of limitations that may. It may not make sense to have a statute of limitations that could run before death.
Representative Atkins.
Actually, you know, If somebody dies far enough out, it clearly ain't stole, or at least it ain't effective stole. right? I mean, it, you, whoever
somebody
was...
Somebody lost some money.
Somebody lost a whole lot of money. So I don't necessarily see that. I do have that concern. I think many members of the House have that concern. If we use a triggering event that could well be 15 years out, that sets a the 2030 as our statute of limitations date, that wouldn't be acceptable. But if we picked a no longer than period, I don't know what that figure is, but at some point it's not STOLE, or it's, at least it's not a,
it's not a concern,
efficient
not
investment. And if that's, you know, 5 years out or four or six, I don't know where that mark is. There have been some talk about that. But I think we can probably address both concerns as long as we have, I don't want to call it a statute of repose because it's not exactly, but a no later than kind of period of time after the policy went into effect. People following on?
Yeah. Senator Watt?
Madam Chair, I'm a little bit confused about the different dates that are in the bill. I mean, I think the statute of limitation applies to the state trying to recover. But I was looking at the House and the Senate language with whether a STOLE has occurred, and there's a 5-year, 4-year test for that. And I thought what Representative Atkins was referring to, maybe actually it's the 5-year, 4-year debate in terms of determining the timetable, the period within which we have to determine whether a STOLE occurred or not. I think it's governed by the 5-year, 4-year discussion, not the statute of limitation, which is the timetable available to the estate to negotiate with the insurance companies. I think that's a separate conversation. If we want to go into the conversation about what is the appropriate time period to determine whether a STOLE act took place, I think that's appropriate for the 5-year, 4-year conversation in Section 5.
I think I get that point. I understand what you're saying. So that's true. And
Madam Chair, I think what we're trying to do, I don't think we're going to finish this in this conference committee since we're supposed to be in caucus and should probably leave by about 10:30 maybe.
Okay.
Is identify some of the issues and some of the things we're trying to really work on, and I think that declaratory judgment statute of limitations is important, and I think Senator Moore points out very clearly that that's the statute of limitations is about the the estate of the insured being able to recover the death benefit if the death benefit's already paid. So it's not working with the insurance company and be involved with whoever had it be the investment company who'd gotten the death benefit. But I do think she's bringing up probably the other big issue in the bill, which is both the time period and how we stop STOLE. I know the Senate has a rebuttable presumption, and the House has prohibiting STOLE. And so I think we need to be looking at there's some issues there that we would probably benefit from discussing a little bit.
And to that point, I mean, the Senate has a pretty strong position and a 66-1 vote. And I know we heard this pretty much for the full Commerce Committee, which was over 2 hours. And I think that the Judiciary Committee hearing went maybe close to three. It seemed like an eternity. No. And I serve on that committee. So, yes, it does. Yes, it does. It does that to you. And so it had considerable hearing, and, you know, it passed 66-1. On the other hand, I'm going to, and I think we felt strongly about the rebuttable presumption. I understand that in the House, I think you also had a strong vote, and that your position would have had even more votes if it hadn't been for the bit of contentious language in Section 3. So, I mean,
a totally different issue.
No, I know. But I mean, I think
that both bodies. Yes, Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that we do come to the table with trying to address the same issue from different directions. And I am interested in hearing a little bit more from our House members. I think in the Senate bill, we were trying to find a way for the system to be self-regulating without attaching external penalties to a prohibition of some sort, because we were concerned about potential cost or how do you regulate it, who will regulate it after the fact, what is the teeth or what's the incentive. And so what we tried to do was, and it was not without, controversy, but what we tried to do was to come up with, and I think we dramatically tightened the language and the presumption from the language as introduced in the Senate. Dramatically tighten it. But we also wanted to create a system that was self-regulating without having to create an external penalty. And I was, this is the first time I looked at the House language, so I would, I had a question about what the penalty would be, because it's a prohibition. So when somebody violates a prohibition, then what's the consequence? Because in our case, if you can't, you don't get the money if you can't prove that it's not stolen. So that's self-regulating, but we have a prohibition. I'm not saying that that's not the right approach. It may be after we've had an opportunity to have a discussion, but I just wondered what the consequences attached to that prohibition. So whether we have that conversation now or earlier, that I would be interested in some input and some context to how that structure works.
Representative Knuth.
And I do think that that's kind of the key question, I think, as we figure out how to come to a consensus on this bill. And I don't know if council could help outline that a little bit about what the prohibitions would be, or what the enforcement mechanism is, basically, and help members of the conference committee understand the differences between the two positions.
Madam Chair and Representative,
yes, Mr. Pender.
Looking at the Section 5 of the House language, where we have a prohibition, and it's in Chapter 68, which is a chapter that's subject to the Department of Commerce jurisdiction. So an insurance company, at least, that that would be regulating the action of insurance companies or other entities that the Commerce Department regulates, which may not be the people that are violating this particular provision. And so otherwise, if someone's committing a violation of this that's not someone the Commerce Department regulates, then the default provision in Chapter 645 would apply, that if something is prohibited by law and no penalty is specified for it, it's a criminal misdemeanor.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you. A question, and I'm sorry if you covered this at the beginning. I would assume the language in both bills was identical when they were introduced. Were they natural companions to each other?
Yes, yes.
And then, so one of them changed.
Versus
natural companions.
I know, maybe you can get matched up later on.
Right, no, these were identical from the beginning,
okay.
Yes.
They entered the system at the same time together. Which body changed Section 5? Was it amended in the Senate to create the rebuttable presumption, or did we change the language from the bill as introduced in the House?
Representative Portman, the original bill had the rebuttable presumption. The Senate tightened that up, so it doesn't appear in the final result in the Senate the same way it was introduced. But the rebuttable presumption, I think, had any of the three elements, and we tightened up the life expectancy evaluation. We tied it to an agreement or to the non-recourse financing. So
if I could ask Representative Knuth, in the House, I remember quite a large amendment that was adopted in civil justice, and I know there was another big amendment adopted in commerce. I'm just wondering if those were the amendments that changed Section 5.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, yeah, that Section 5 was pretty much the focus of the major discussion. I mean, that we're outlining some other issues, and there's some other differences that I think are important, but probably don't rise to the same level of discussion as Section 5. And I think, just so we, so as Mr. Pender said, if this section is violated, it's regulated under commerce. But if it's violated by someone not regulated under commerce, there would basically be a misdemeanor. Okay. And if you could help the committee understand the enforcement mechanism in Section 5 of the Senate bill, just so we can have a clear understanding of what we're comparing.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm not familiar with the Department of Commerce and their regulating mechanism, and part of counsel could help me to understand what would be the consequence if it's an entity that's regulated by the Department of Commerce. Would there be a loss of a license and ability to operate, or citations, or what is the usual consequence?
Mr. Stain.
Madam Chair, I think the General Commerce Enforcement Authority is in Chapter 45, and it, you know, runs the gamut: civil fines, injunctive relief, suspension of license, suspension to sell insurance in Minnesota, and those kinds of things. In this bill, I'm not sure those kinds of enforcement actions are as important as the ability of the estate of the insured to recover the money. I think that's the kind of the core remedy in this bill, as I see it, or one of them. So that's kind of how the Senate language in Section 5 talks into setting up a resumption of a rebuttable presumption of stolen practices. And the remedy section of the Senate bill, at least, says that if a policy was effected by using stolen practices, then the insured's estate can bring an action to get the money back. I think that's probably the stiffest remedy in the bill, if you will, on that issue. But Mr. Pender is absolutely correct that this is an insurance regulatory statute. At least the insurer, if the insurer violated any of this in here, they'd be subject to enforcement remedies under Chapter 45 as well.
Madam Chair?
Representative Atkins.
What I've heard is if the goal is to avoid external regulations, with a rebuttable presumption, what we've done is we've created, since 60A is not going to apply to the folks that are engaged in this is going to be folks outside of 60A. We revert or we default to 645. We are creating a rebuttable presumption that a whole lot of misdemeanors are occurring. Versus if we do it in the House fashion, which prohibits the practice, rather than creating a rebuttable presumption of a whole bunch of them occurring, we designate this as a, what I'm saying, Senator, is that under a rebuttable presumption, we are going to have this many that might be weaned down to a lesser amount. Under the House language, it is here and it doesn't grow larger. Is that a fair? I look to either Mr. Pender or Mr. Stang, that I think that's what I'm pretty confident actually that that's what I heard. That there's a rebuttable presumption that there would be a misdemeanor under the Senate language that could then be disproved.
And I have a question about why people wouldn't be under the, who wouldn't be under the jurisdiction of the Department of Commerce. I mean, an insurance agent, somebody selling insurance would.
Aren't we talking, though, about the buyers?
The investors.
The investors?
Well, yes.
And you could certainly shoehorn them in, I'm sure, if you had an aggressive department, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the point is still the same, was you'd be creating a presumption that this is occurring. So if the goal is to prevent, and I don't know if we need a fiscal note relative to it or not, if the enforcement would rise to that that level. But if the goal is to try to prevent external regulation and limit it to the, my sense is that the whole point of this has been to, so that in the civil action, the estate versus the insurance company, that we have a setup as far as how that's going to play out. I hadn't even thought about the external regulation that would be necessary. It's a good point.
Ms. Rowan, do you want to comment here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just a couple comments about the background of the rebuttable presumption that might be helpful. There is no penalty, per se, in our understanding, for a violation of the rebuttable presumption. It's what applies if there's a civil case. If the insurance company takes action to rescind the policy in court, the rebuttable presumption applies. The investor has to say this was not a STOLI policy. If they do that successfully, then the insurance company has to prove that it's STOLI. It's not intended to be any sort of standalone prohibition that or thing that you can violate.
Then we better make that clear.
Representative Atkins, I think, is
we have
has questions
of,
about this.
Yeah, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. But if it's in Section 68, and then the default is to 645, we do have all of the enforcement measures that the department would have a responsibility, an expectation that they would follow up on. We'd also have, if it defaulted to 645, the typical criminal prosecution and enforcement that would be necessary. So if we want to, maybe we should put it in a different section or something, but that was my sense from what I heard from counsel.
Wow, and I'm not sure that that's what we intended. So we have to mull this over. Our Senator Moa.
Well, my reason for asking that is that my assumption was that by creating the rebuttable presumption, which is a civil remedy, it doesn't exclude the remedy, the prohibition under state law, Department of Commerce action, or any potential criminal penalty.
Right.
That you get a twofer under the Senate language. That it, in essence, is a hammer to say to the investors, because we've got the investors, the insurance company, and the individual in the middle, and we've got their estate. We've basically got four different players here. And that if something like this were to happen, that the Senate language creates an opportunity where the state, the regulatory agency would have an interest in regulating the activities. But that's already, I'm presuming,
there,
if we need to make that explicit, we do that. But I think that the Senate language goes a step further to create the self-regulating system to send the signal to the investors to say, and not only will the insurance company and this type of activities be regulated, but hey, Mr. Investor, you don't get your money. So don't do this. And I think that the way that we go after the investors is to go where the pocketbook is, which is to say, you don't get the money if you engage in this. I don't think it precludes us, and if it does, we ought to make sure that, you know, that we do decide to go either way. I just want to make sure that either position takes into consideration both consequences.
Right. I mean, the Senate language is a strong deterrent to abuses by investors. I mean, that's the point of it. So, Representative Portman.
Thanks. I just want to make sure I understand the conversation we're having. And is it about whether a state regulatory agency has the power to help deter these practices, or whether the only remedy is really a private remedy in order to enforce the private right? And that our concern is that we set up something where either the Commerce Department, if they become aware of it, can take some action, or the Attorney General can bring, you know, a private, whatever we call that cause of action under 8.31, to stop a practice. Are we trying to make it clear that the private litigant has a cause of action, but also that the state regulatory system that protects consumers has a clear way that they get in and say, hey, that's outside the what lines we painted on appeal?
Representative Atkins.
Under the current, as I understand from what I've heard, right now we have a presumption in all type of cases. So we've just shifted even in criminal matters, which the department has the authority for, or if it defaults to 645 under a misdemeanor, we've shifted the presumption, if you use the Senate language, that you now have to disprove your guilt. That is a bit of a monumental change in the American system of law. And I don't think that was the intent, but that's how this would be, how this would move forward, is that we would presume someone guilty, and they would have to prove their innocence.
Representative Hartman.
And, I'm sure I don't understand this as well as the chair of the Commerce Committee, but what I'm wondering is, for the private litigant, in, you know, say I find out my dad was been subject to one of these, and I am going to try to take some action. And as a Minnesotan, you know, what sort of remedies do I want spelled out most clearly in the statute so that maybe I'm not alone? For example, I can go to the Department of Commerce and say, here's something that happened in the sale of this policy and complain about it, and Commerce can do something maybe before the death, and so that I'm not just left with the litigation remedy. And I wonder if, I don't know, but I wonder if the Senate language with the rebuttable presumption kind of forces for me to get my remedy to do the private action. And I think, Senator Moore, you were kind of getting to this point, whether maybe there's something to the House language where if you just have a clear prohibition, it says to the Commerce Department, you can take action to, do some sort of disciplinary action to the entity engaged in the act. So it's not just all on the consumer having to hire a lawyer and hope for the best in court.
Representative Atkins.
On that point, Madam Chair, I think we're mixing two different things. The under either provision, House or Senate, if it's put into 68, and Council can correct me if I'm wrong here, but the department still has authority there to help
right.
the consumer under
right.
either
right.
provision.
Right.
It's the rebuttable presumption, and I'm Commerce, and that I wasn't on the committee, but I think the concern they had is rebuttal presumptions. I think I was told by those folks there's like 34 in Minnesota law, and now we're talking about a shifting rebuttable presumption both in civil matters but also in the criminal context, and it's a funky world when you start talking rebuttable presumptions. Is why I think it made that committee a little inky.
Yes, Representative Hartman.
My other question then was, if we have a rebuttable presumption, does that create a situation where the commissioner of the Department of Commerce can't really for sure say this conduct is outside the boundaries because it's a rebuttable presumption, and in order to get to the point of conclusion where you're actually saying there was wrongdoing, you have to go where then the burden shifts and, I'm not sure if they can wade in.
Representative Moi may have something.
On this point, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, Representative. I have to say that I have heard this argument about presumed guilty on the Senate floor, and I'm not convinced. The idea of a rebuttable presumption set out elements, and when you meet those elements or those potential elements, it creates a presumption. And I think that it doesn't create any fundamental shifts in our criminal justice system. The reason why people are arrested, the reason why people are charged, the reason why we have allegations is because in law we've set out elements. And when those particular elements have been met, then people are charged with a particular crime. And then we move forward with the trial to see if those elements could be proved or proven. And I think what we are creating here in the Senate language is we've laid out very clearly and very simply elements that if they were present in a transaction, mm-hmm. triggers a potential stolen activity. And that's when the burden shifts to the proof process to say this, actually, these are the documentation to show that this doesn't happen. So whether we maybe I'm a little bit cynical, and I think that we don't actually live in a world where people are presumed innocent until they're guilty. Actually, in my world, people are presumed guilty. And it's up to them or whatever circumstances they fall under to have to prove that somehow they're not guilty. I mean, that's just in the real world how it operates. And I think that the way that we've set it up creates very clear, very simple elements that once it's triggered, and I think everybody would agree, the industry agree, I think that those of us around the table would agree, that the mechanism that we have set up or laid out in the Senate language clearly shows that if those elements were present, that there is a stolen transaction. And it's just a matter of moving forward to see the different proof to prove in those unusual circumstances where maybe the facts really do make the case. What I was interested in the House language was to make sure that I liked the idea of bringing the whole system under state regulation. And I have been presuming all along that the Senate language was a twofer, that it was assumed that these transactions would fall under commerce regulation, and that what we were doing in the Senate language was adding a secondary level of assurance to the system to self-regulate. So if we had the Senate language, we actually got a twofer. We got the House language, we got the idea or the regulatory aspect that is built into the House language, and you get the secondary level of protection by having these people say if you meet these elements and you can't prove that it's not a STOLE, then you don't get the money. And that's the best deterrent. And so I don't think that we're fundamentally shifting in any way. We're just creating some elements to say that if you do these things, then it's presumed. And I think that as a matter of public policy, we do that because we lay out basic elements that says thou shalt not X, Y, and Z. And if these elements are there, then we think that you've triggered an act that we disapprove.
No, I think Senator Moore captures exactly where the Senate was coming from in terms of we wanted a strong deterrent. We wanted the self-regulation, if you will. We wanted investors not to be engaging in this this practice.
It's
Representative Knuth, and then...
Madam Chair, and I this is sort of going in between how, when we're talking about remedy, how do we stop STOLE, and then what the enforcement of remedies are, it sounds like, and I'm not sure from Representative Atkins' description, he's very uncomfortable with a rebuttable presumption in a criminal proceeding. But we're, and this is kind of, I learn every time I talk about this bill, I learn something. We're looking in the civil remedy of you don't get the money, investor, don't do this. And that's what the rebuttable presumption is trying to do. But then there's also the prohibited practices part, which I think is probably more clear in the House language. If there's criminal action taken by the department, and I'm not a civil justice expert, but so we're really differentiating between the deterrent, which is more in the civil area where you don't get the payout if you're an investor, if this is a STOLE policy, which isn't as strong in the House language. And then, but the state regulatory more criminal action is stronger in the House language as a prohibited practice under 60A, and then 64, 645, or whatever that other one is. Am I making that differentiation correct? So I'm not sure what we want to do or if we want to do both or one, but really thinking about the civil remedy of not getting the money as an investor buying STOLE policies, and that, well, I would say more deterrent, which is we want to deter STOLE rather than just cleaning up the mess afterwards, which is what we're left with a lot right now. But then we also want to have the cleaning up the mess afterwards part in the department, which is what I think the House language has more strongly. But maybe I'm getting this discussion wrong.
Representative Hillstrom,
thank you, Madam Chair. I actually wanted to get back to this, the criminal elements being laid out in a presumption of guilt versus innocence. Is there anywhere in Minnesota law under the criminal section where you are presumed guilty in the law and you have to prove yourself innocent rather than the state having to make their case against you? I don't think there is. I mean, I understand that some people in practice say that once you've been charged with a crime, you as the defendant have to prove your innocence. But you don't have to, take the witness stand in opposition to yourself. You don't have to, give any incriminating evidence. And if you presume guilt under criminal law, I don't think we do that anywhere else.
We did it in Photocop, but
okay.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that the intent here was to make it criminal. It's to deter the practice. I mean, it's a civil issue, so, or matter. So, Mr. Pender.
Madam Chair, I mean, would be possible to make the presumption apply just in the civil context. Or another way of looking at it, too, is that I mean, this is called a presumption, and if we look at it, but if we look at it in the criminal context, I mean, you would still, if you were prosecuting the case, you would still have to prove that each of these things listed under the
right.
presumption are actually present. So, I mean, it's not presumed guilty in some sense where the state doesn't have to prove anything. The state would still have to prove that each of those elements is
Are you suggesting we could have some clarifying language to limit this to civil matters? Mm-hmm. Senator Gerlach.
I was just going to point out, I was trying to think of an example. Like you said, I'm a lawyer, but I think the county's child protective services, I think, when there's an allegation made, I think children were removed and moved to essentially put you in incest to get your children back. I don't know the legal implications of it, but I think that certainly happens in practice. Yeah.
Madam
Representative
Chair, it's 10.
Yes,
35,
I
and
yeah.
I think we could probably find more and more issues to talk about today.
Right, but this is kind of the crux of of this here.
And so I don't know how much longer we want to put this keep this discussion going because we have session 11
no,
and we
and I presume
stop
I figured we only really had till 10:30. I thought I understood that to begin with. So, now, am I correct that the gavel changes hands like every 24 hours.
Yeah.
So, if you want to meet later this afternoon, will you let me know? I don't know. Can people show me by their hands if you could be here this afternoon? We have the room for the afternoon, and that's the good thing because the rooms are disappearing because of the omnibus bill. So
it's nice outside.
I used to love that going. Yes. Right.
Session.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'd be happy to bounce back and forth.
Okay.
Me too.
Okay.
Well,
you're available?
6.
Because the Senate is going till 2 today, I think.
Till 4 to 6.
We have the room from 4 to 6, so if we can.
It depends on how our
right.
session goes.
So. Okay, so I don't know that it's important that we recess
no,
at
I
this
don't.
Point.
Not
I think we will. I think that, excuse me, Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, you can recess.
I think I will.
A couple of us can just
come and adjourn if we can't do it. So the conference committee's in recess. I want to thank everybody for being here. And yes.